Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Dr. Adam Rutherford crams a brief history of everyone who ever lived into an hour to tell us the stories in our genes. Dr. Adam Rutherford is a science writer and broadcaster. He studied genetics at University College London, and during his PhD on the developing eye, he was part of a team that identified the first genetic cause of a form of childhood blindness. He has written and presented many award-winning series and programmes for the BBC, including the flagship weekly Radio 4 programme Inside Science, The Cell for BBC 4, and Playing God on the Rise of Synthetic Biology for the leading science strand Horizon, as well as writing for the science pages of The Guardian. His first book, Creation, which we talked about in a previous Little Atoms, which was on the origin of life and synthetic biology, was published in 2013 to outstanding reviews and was shortlisted for the Wellcome Trust Prize. And Adam's latest book, which we're going to talk about today, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Story in Our Genes. Adam, welcome back.
Hello, Little Atoms. Hello, Neil.
What's this book about, then?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a pretty ambitious title, isn't it?
It is.
Well, I thought, having dealt with the whole of life on Earth in my last book, I'd just restrict it to just the whole of human life this time around. No, what it is it's an attempt to look at human history from our deep prehistory right up to modern history using what is effectively a new tool in the historian's tool shed, which is DNA. And it's only been available to us in the last few years that we can challenge or reassess or reanalyze and verify some of the stories from history using this new source. And it's really important to me that I don't, it's not better than traditional history forms, it's complementary to. Mm-hmm. So, history, archaeology, medicine, psychology, these are much longer standing academic disciplines than genetics. And genetics is the sort of new kid on the block. But it's had a profound effect on our understanding of human history in just 5 years. So it felt like the right time to say there's a new way of analysing human history, and that's what I'm doing in the book.
Now, you do a little recap at the beginning about, the history of genetics and the history of life, and we did all of that when we talked about creation, so we're not going to go into that. I just want to get straight into the descent of man. And of course, we'll have all have seen from our school books, everyone will be familiar with that, the diagram of, a chimp on the left-hand side and a few slightly straightening up people and then a guy with an umbrella and a briefcase at the far side as a sort of illustration of, how we got here, how modern humans got here. What's up with that, then?
Yeah, I've got two big problems with that. So the original is called The March of Progress, and it comes from a French textbook, and it has, as you say, it's universally recognised, and when we were growing up, it is in every textbook, and even if you go to Down House today, where Darwin did all of his best work, you can buy mugs with The March of Progress on it, and it is problematic. It's wrong in two ways, and I think should be outlawed. The first way in which it's wrong is it implies direction to our evolution. It says that there was a point in history where we were monkeys, and over time we marched in this line, progressing each step. We became more upright, bigger, sturdier, and then eventually we're upright and white and bearded and using tools. And what it says is, this is how we got here. Now, evolution has no direction, mm-hmm. We know that. Any implication in that diagram that there was direction from being an ape or a lemur or an earlier primate to being a white-bearded man with a spear is just not how evolution works. Each one of those organisms on the march of progress is as evolved as anything else. So that's the first thing that's wrong with it. The second thing is more just sort of factual, new data. So again, when we were growing up, in the textbooks, we had these nice, neat, branching family trees populated by some of the ancient humans or earlier primate species that we know about. You know, things like Lucy or Australopithecus afarensis or Homo erectus and Homo heidelbergensis and all those ones. And we drew these nice tree-like patterns, and that said, this is how we got here. Now, with genetics and with more specimens and genetics complementing paleoanthropology, so the study of old bones, we don't know how we got here. It's effectively impossible to draw a line between any human species from the last 100,000 years. We can draw dotted lines at best, but there is no tree. There's a diagram in figure one in this is from Chris Stringer. He's the sort of doyen of paleoanthropology in this country. And it's the best attempt at a tree that we have now. We don't have branches anymore. We have sort of blobs. And there's a huge section at the bottom left, which is just blurred out. And it says unknown relationships, which basically is, you know, scientific code for saying no idea. And that's great. That's how science should be. Mm. You know, we don't know how we got here. The more we know about our deep history, our prehistory, the more we realise that we've been, if not wrong, just much more confident than we should have been with less data. So that's good times.
Paleoanthropology is a relatively recent thing anyway. It's only a couple of hundred years or so since anybody discovered the first ancient human remains.
Yes.
First fossilised human remains. So now DNA, now, you know, genetics, what difference has that made?
An unbelievable amount. And it really is only 6 years old in any sort of measurable, meaningful form. So yeah, you're right. So the first three non-Homo sapiens human specimens found were all Neanderthals, not identified as Neanderthals until the second one in the 1860s. And since then, we've discovered, you know, hundreds, dozens, thousands of bones and different species. We name new species, I think, a little bit too casually. And also the whole concept of species in human evolution, I think, is deeply problematic. But, you know, the first one identified was Neanderthals, Homo neanderthalensis, and we know the separation of them from the bones looks like about 600,000 years ago, something like that. And in 2009 and 10, we sequenced the Neanderthal genome in total, which is a phenomenal thing to do. You know, that's only like 7 or 8 years after we sequenced living humans' genome. But managed to get a full genome out, and it said, you know, it was amazing treasure trove of information. But the one that we all know about, which I think is not that even that controversial anymore, is that most people know that almost all Europeans carry Neanderthal DNA in them, and the way that Neanderthal DNA is distributed across the world is geographically restricted in a way which is interesting to understanding our own evolution. But the key thing it says is that we interbred with Neanderthals, and not only did we interbred with them a lot and successfully. And so then you get into trouble with the whole concept of a species. So if a species is defined as something, two organisms that can't have offspring that are fertile themselves, that's the most common species definition. You and me, I can tell by looking at you that we carry Neanderthal DNA, both mm-hmm. of us, which means that our ancestors successfully had sex with Neanderthals and their offspring were fertile, which according to the old species definition means they cannot have been a separate species from us. Now, I had this conversation with Alice Roberts, right? You know, friend of the programme, friend of science. I had this conversation with her about 5 years ago, and she sort of adamantly said, no, they were a different species to us. And then about 6 months ago, when she was reading the book and we were talking about this, she sort of grudgingly admitted that genetics has been useful in the end in revising our understanding. A lot of paleoanthropologists have been hostile to it, but I think it's inevitable now that we have to change the way we think about human evolution because genetics says something different.
The tricky thing, the ironic thing, I guess, here is that, you know, most ancient human remains are found in, you know, in Africa, in deserts and places where they're where it's hot, where they're more likely to have been, you know, things are preserved. But of course, that means there's no DNA. The DNA has been destroyed. So you're much more likely to find DNA in cold places or damp places even, wherein the remains that you find are not as good.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, as ever, nothing is perfect. But you're right, we know much more about the ancient DNA of northern climes because it's colder and in drier places where DNA has a better chance of survival, of being preserved, because it's pretty robust. But the more you move into Africa where it's hot and possibly humid, the less likely, the more difficult it is to retrieve ancient DNA from old bones. So we do know much more about Europe and Russia and that those migrations after out of Africa than we do for the rest of the world put together. There's also a sort of Eurocentric view on this. Much of the research is done in Europe and in the States, who are also focused on Europe. We don't know nearly enough, disproportionately much less, about the Native Americans and the indigenous people of the Americas, partly for that reason, but also there are some really interesting cultural barriers in there. So there's a sort of long-standing hostility towards Europeans, which was reinforced in the 90s by scientists behaving badly, taking samples with permission and then using them to do stuff to test for diseases without permission. And also the idea that if you could identify where a tribe was from, which you can't, but if you could, then the attempts at reparations for all the moving, you know, the ill treatment and genocide that Europeans inflicted upon Native Americans, the reparations might be altered. So, you know, Native Americans have been shifted around over hundreds of years by European settlers. And if it turns out that, you know, you think that you're a member of the Sioux Nation and genetics told you that you're actually a member of a completely different tribe, which it can't do, but if it could do that, then you might think that you're, you know, not entitled to some of those reparation rights. So we know far less than we should do about the Americas.
Let's talk about some of the other species of early humans, and I want to talk about Neanderthals in a slightly more detail afterwards. But the others, there's about, what, about seven or eight now, other ones?
Well, I mean, the number is changing rapidly. So if you think that, again, you know, when I was growing up, we knew of, in the last 50,000 years, basically it was us and Neanderthals, and possibly the end of Homo erectus. But we don't have any DNA from Homo erectus. We can all of the stories in the book are ones that are informed by DNA. And since then, you know, in the last 10 years, we discovered the Flores people of Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Now, we couldn't get DNA out of them because it was too hot and humid, and their bones were not actually fossilised. And that's a shame because they're an odd island group of people, probably derived from an earlier Homo erectus, probably distant cousins from us, but still lived in the recent enough past that we should be able to get DNA out of them. Mm-hmm. If the conditions were right. So far, the conditions haven't been right. So that's a shame. So that's one. And then in 2009, there was this amazing, earth-shattering discovery of just a fingertip and a tooth in a cave in Siberia, in Denisova. And a tooth and a fingertip are not enough to define a new species morphologically, but they got DNA out of the tooth. Teeth are very good for protecting DNA. And the Denisova individual, who was a teenage girl, was too different from both Neanderthal genomes and Homo sapiens genomes to be either of the two. So at that point, again, species concepts becomes problematic because it is the Denisovan girl represents a new species of human from 50,000 years ago. But we can't define her as a new species because species are defined by morphological characteristics. So that's annoying. And then we see Denisovan DNA all across the further east you go, the higher proportions you see in living people. It peaks in Melanesia where it reaches about 10%, which is massive. And then when you compare Denisovans with Neanderthals with Homo sapiens, there's another gap in there, which is that they're not similar enough to each other, the hypothesis being that the differences must be accounted for by an unknown species of human. And we can tell when that happened, but we can't tell what that human was. And I think that's close to magic. We're identifying human species based not on any physical remains, just DNA. It may be that we know the species already, but we haven't got DNA from that species. Mm-hmm. Chris Stringer thinks it's probably Homo heidelbergensis, and it may well be. But until that identification, That is just an unimaginable breakthrough 10 years ago, 5 years ago even. We're talking about identifying species that we don't know of any physical remains, which is nuts.
And those other, the other species, which are the ones that are too old for us really to be able to extract any DNA from, like Homo erectus to, you know, Agaster and Homo habilis, is it? Mm. The handyman.
The handyman, yeah.
All of those, are these species, if again, problematic to call them species, but are all of these different groups cohabiting, like around at the, roughly the same time? Are we talking, how far, are we going back, like at least 500,000 years, if not?
Yeah,
if not
in fact longer with some of those, yeah, those species that we call Homo, so in the genus Homo. But again, yeah, some of them have clearly have morphological differences which are easy to define. And that's traditionally how we've said this is a separate species. Mm-hmm. But it becomes, where it becomes interesting and difficult is when you're at the margins, when one specimen looks a lot like another, but we put it in this category and not in this category. And that's where it becomes interesting, and that's where scientific debates and arguments happen, and that's all fine. But I think what is really clear, and I think we're talking about the first chapter in the book here, so the, you know, prehistory, I think the main conclusion, if there is one conclusion, is that human history, or at least human prehistory, is far, far more messy than we ever thought it was. And that we weren't a discrete population who marched across the land in that sort of, well, I describe it as the sort of dad's army arrows. That's how we draw migratory patterns of ancient humans. And it's just a narrative, a simplistic narrative, which is, I'm beginning to think, is not helpful scientifically. When we talk about migration in ancient humans, the distances and times that we're talking about are often thousands of miles over tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And I think the word migration conjures up images of Syrian refugees or contemporary migration, the way we think about migration today. There's nothing like that. I mean, we're talking about small groups, tribal groups of humans moving at a rate of a mile a year. It's like moving from Kentish Town to Tufnell Park. Mm-hmm. And over 100,000 years, they've gone from Central Africa or East Africa to Siberia or even to Australia. But the rate of change is just phenomenally slow.
I'm Ben Goldacre. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Neanderthals, then. So you've already mentioned that, like, you can recognise that both of us have got their DNA. That's basically because we're Europeans, fundamentally. Yep. And there was obviously this, you know, crossbreeding, cross-habitation between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals over the year, and, like, you know, how they were gradually wiped out or whatever, if that's even the right way to describe it, is debatable. But looking at the idea about our own DNA, how much we have, now you've had this measured, you've got...
Well, it comes out at 2.7 from a commercial company, 23andMe, which is standard average for Europeans.
Yeah. That's average, very average.
Yeah, genetics.
3.2%.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that is high.
It is high, isn't
from
it?
From 23andMe?
Yeah.
Well, how about that?
3.2%.
That is unusually high and quite interesting. The commercial companies tend to test higher than academic
So they're over-egging it, definitely.
But yeah, probably.
But what does that even mean? So, like, you know, so I have more Neanderthal DNA than you do.
Yeah.
By actually quite a significant amount. Yeah. But, I mean, what does that even represent?
Yeah, sure. So, well, it represents a not insignificant proportion of your genome. Mm-hmm. So 3.7% or even 2.7% of your total DNA is actually more than your Y chromosome.
Yeah.
So proportionally, you're more Neanderthal than you are man. Both of us. Which is a kind of odd, meaningless thing to say, but it's quite fun. But it's not grouped together in a particular area. And what it shows is that we talk about gene flow events, which is a nice euphemism for sex, but it doesn't really mean one individual having sex with another individual. Gene flow events really refer to population-level breeding. And from the we can tell, the statistics of DNA means now that we can tell lots of things about behaviour back in the day when these gene flow events were taking place. So, for example, we can tell to a certain extent whether it was males with females, male Homo sapiens with female Neanderthals, or whichever way around. We can also tell, much more interestingly, I think, we can tell, and this is relatively new, We can tell whether the genes that have entered the other genome, introgression is the idea, whether they're being selected for. And this, I think, again, is a completely sort of new area of genetics that we can say, well, we no longer rely on, we don't actually need to know the phenotype, so the physical characteristic, to say whether it was selected or not. We can look at the genes and say, using some pretty sophisticated techniques, we can say, well, this area of the genome has been undergoing natural selection. And then you can look in that area of the genome and say, well, what's in there? What genes are in there? And the closer we get to the present, the easier it becomes. But one of the things about Neanderthals is it looks like that whatever genes introgressed from Neanderthals to Homo sapiens, they are very slowly being negatively selected. They're not majorly deleterious. They don't cause any major diseases. But over time, it looks like that number is going down. And it may well be the case that we've inherited bits and pieces of genome from Neanderthals, which do have a subtle genetic effect on us, in that we might there is a gene which we inherited from Neanderthals, some people did, that it slightly increases the risk of diabetes and various things like that. It's none of these are major shifts in evolution. It's not like we're defined by our Neanderthal DNA, but it just shows that historically we were not nearly as distantly related as we thought, and were perfectly capable of having healthy, fertile offspring with Neanderthals. We know that Neanderthal population size was always small, much smaller than Homo sapiens, and we know that the overlap between Neanderthals and humans modern humans in time and space was short. And yes, they did go extinct. Although they live on in us, in our genomes, we're not Neanderthals. We are separate from them. We carry their genes. Their legacy lives on with us. But the people, the tribal groups that physically looked like Neanderthals, they are now gone.
Now, we always thought, you know, the very idea of the Neanderthal conjures up this idea of them being like a sort of, you know, a hunched, big, schooled cave person.
Mm.
But now, you know, we believe that, you know, they sewed clothes and made art and things and, you know, had quite advanced societies. One of the questions that's always been debated about them was whether or not they could talk.
Mm.
And you talk about this in the book, and I think it's sort of interesting in terms of the, you know, the gene that suggests that they might talk, the FOXP2 gene, because that tells us something about humans as well.
Yeah, it does. It's a funny thing because, I mean, as I write in the book, in 1994 or 5, when I was an undergraduate and I did paleoanthropology, just as a module because I was mostly doing genetics, one of the classic essay questions is, did Neanderthals talk? And the answer is, it looks like, based on their morphological, the structures of their throats, and by implication the size of their brains, and particularly the hyoid bone, which is this bone under your neck, which is very, very fine-tuned for speech in us, but it looks like in Neanderthals they were at least capable of a similar level of speech, the sophisticated speech patterning that humans do. So that was the answer in 1994. And then we did the human genome. 20 years later, we do the genome for Neanderthals. And as you say, FOXP2 is a gene that much has been made of in terms of its significance in our own ability to speak. And it's clearly very important, but in a way it touches on a much bigger theme in the book, which is what genes can tell us about characteristics. And many people have talked about FOXP2 as being the language gene. It's not the language gene. It's clear that it's necessary for language, but not sufficient, because there aren't really any genes for anything. Mm-hmm. Neanderthals had FOXP2, which was similar to us and different from chimpanzees. And the associations with that particular version of FOXP2 is consistent with the versions that we have that enable our speech. And we know from it, when it's mutated in humans, that can cause speech problems in families and in pedigrees. So the sort of final conclusion of that section is, the answer to that essay, could Neanderthals speak, is exactly the same as it was in 1994, just using a completely new, brand new set of evidence. It had FOXP2 that was similar to us, it had big brains, it had the physical structure, the morphology that would allow speech. Could they speak? We don't know.
Just one more thing before we move away from ancient humans. There's been a surprisingly old remains found in the UK relatively recently, much older than we originally thought.
Are you talking about Haysborough in Norfolk? Yeah, so no actual human remains found there, but much evidence of human occupation of culture. So at some point soon, someone will find an ancient human bone there, and that will be big news. Actually, there are footprints. There are footprints off the coast that are only visible at low tide. So humans were definitely there in some form over the last 900,000 years.
Well, bearing in mind that that's on the coast, I wanted to talk about how they got there, with us being an island and everything. So there probably is a good reason why no remains have been found, isn't there?
Well, it wasn't the coast then. It was a land bridge, so we call it Doggerland, and only referenced these days in the shipping forecast when they talk about Dogger Bank, which is now a sort of sand mound underneath the North Sea. But 500,000 years ago, you know, when the years that we're talking, it was a land bridge that was continuous with Europe, and the Thames was much further north. And so that route, until the last ice age, was the route by which woolly rhinos, woolly mammoths, giant beavers, and some form of humans made it across to what we now call the UK, and made it all the way up to, you know, Carnarvon in Wales, where we think there are Neanderthal remains, or we've discovered Neanderthal remains, and all of the various other ancient humans that we've found across the UK. We're not a human bone-rich island, and it'd be great to really discover who the first Britons were and when they really turned up. For now, you know, we know much more about Europe than we do about the UK.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Adam Rutherford. We're talking about his book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Stories in Our Genes. And Adam, we left off in ancient Norfolk. And I want to come forward to, like, to more, although still a couple of thousand years, but more modern British Isles. You talk about a project, the People of the British Isles Project, which is a recent attempt to map the DNA of people of the UK, which has led to a lot of interesting and surprising conclusions about, you know, we all think, oh, you know, I come from East Anglia, therefore I'm obviously come from the Vikings, or, like, you know, I'm Welsh, I'm obviously a Celt, and actually there's a a lot of doubt been put into that sort of thing now.
Yeah, it was a brilliant study. I think it was my favourite study of that year. And it was... So basically what they did is they took DNA from 2,039 living Brits. All of them... One of the criteria were that they had to have been born within 80 miles of their grandparents. And what that did is make sure they were sampling people who had been relatively stable. And also, crucially, it basically excluded much of the 20th century migration from the places that we used to call the colonies. So basically people like me. And then they took something like 10,000 samples from mainland Europe. And again, this is a statistical technique. So genetics has become a computational science because you're dealing with enormous amounts of data which you wouldn't be able to process without computer power. What you do is you get their genome samples from these 2,000 people. You plug them into a computer, so they've got the sequence in the computer. And then you ask a computer using a particular type of software to group them together in the ones that are most similar to each other. Now, it's worth pointing out that me and you and everyone who's ever lived, our genomes are incredibly similar, 99.9999%. The differences between us are very, very slight. But we've got to the stage in genetics and human genetics now where we can detect the minorest, the most subtle, wispy differences between people. So we are basically all the same, but this level of fine-scale mapping is new, less than 2 years old. And so you ask the computer to group them together at this sort of scale, and then you ask the computer to place those groupings on the map. Now, everyone thought that what you'd get is sort of even distribution of all of those people and all those genotypes across the country, like sort of pebbles on a beach. And what happened is we saw a really, really clear demarcation of different areas of the country based on similarities between people who'd been relatively stable for a long time. And what it looked like and what it is basically a recapitulation of British history over several thousand years. And this is why it was stunning, because being an island, we're interesting, we've been invaded, and migration is slightly different for islands than it is for continuous land masses. But what we saw is lots of interesting stories from history, some of which verified history, some of which challenged. The challenges, I think, are the most interesting ones. So, for example, there's no such thing as Celts, right? You try telling that to people who say I'm Celtic, and they get quite cross. But basically, there are three groups of people that we refer to as Celts who are in Cornwall and Brittany, so together, Wales and Scottish. Now, according to these data from the people of the British Isles, the Cornish Celts and the Welsh Celts and the Scottish Celts are more different from each other than they are from mainland Britain. So they're three distinct populations. They don't have a shared ancestry, and they don't necessarily have a shared culture. So that's one thing. And then we see things like, when you compare the main body of the UK, which corresponds to Danelaw, or before it, Roman Britain, and in those people you don't see Danish Viking DNA or Danish DNA, and you don't see Italian DNA. So what does that say about history? Like, the interpretation is, it says that, well, we had several hundred years of Roman and then several hundred years of Danish rule, Danelaw. But they didn't integrate. They didn't leave their DNA. They didn't have sex with the locals, and in a way that subsequent invaders, such as the Angles and the Saxons and various other European invaders, did. And even north of the border, and where you see lots of Norwegian Viking DNA or lots of Norwegian DNA, which indicates that they came and they did integrate in a nice way. You know, you even see weird stuff like the boundary. The difference between the people of Cornwall and the people of Devon is demarcated by the county line, which is, that's an interesting...
Which happens to be a river.
It happen to be a river, and that's a good barrier to gene flow. But we didn't think we'd see that level of demarcation. So you've got this new tool which says we can challenge history by taking living people, looking at their DNA in a particular way, very sophisticated statistical way, and saying, well, how does this correspond with the way that we think the history of this country has evolved? And, you know, they're going to just sort of roll this technique out across the world from now on.
Well, taking that to an even more extreme level, you talk about a similar project in Iceland. But of course, Iceland is a place where they have these like incredible records anyway of like all the people who have ever lived in Iceland, pretty much.
Yeah, Iceland is the geneticist's dream. It is my favourite country, apart from the UK, anyway, because it's so weird and beautiful. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a geneticist's dream for two or three reasons. One is it wasn't occupied before the 9th century. So the first people to come to Iceland are Norwegian and Danish Vikings. We do think there were some monks there beforehand, but they didn't leave children because monks are not meant to do that. So it's not occupied until the 9th century because, as you say, the tradition of the sagas, half of the sagas are myths and legends and about fighting trolls and pillaging and raping and drinking and those types of things. But many of the sagas are really just genealogy records. They're records of people and families, and a bit like the begatting sections in the Bible. And what that means is that if you combine those two things, so the fact that it wasn't unpopulated until the 9th century and they have genealogical records, it means that effectively we have known the names of every single person that's ever lived in this country. Also helped by the fact that the population has always been small, it's never gone above 400,000, so you know, about the size of, I don't know, Leicester, Ipswich. But anyway, what it means is that we know the history of the people of this one island. And the geneticists realised this in the 90s and sort of capitalised on it by saying, well, now we've got this new tool, genetics, which enables us to do a similar sort of analysis. And so we know more about the genetics of the Icelanders than we do pretty much any nation on Earth. And they're fascinating, fascinating people.
A common, not a myth, because it turns out to be true, but you know, a thing that everybody will have heard about, you know, about genealogy, about DNA, is that, you know, we're all related to famous people from the past,
yeah,
or something, or kings. And you talk in this book about this idea that, like, everybody in Europe now is related to Charlemagne.
Yeah.
So is that how does that work?
Yeah, it is factually correct that. When I do this in lectures, I say, you know, when I say it's not conceptual, I'm not, you know, it's not metaphorical, it's you are literally descended from Charlemagne. Basically, it's the difference between the way we talk about family trees and genealogy and the way families actually work. Most people pass through history without leaving any trace that they ever existed. When we do genealogy, and there's a great interest in tracing our own families, we tend to focus on the people who did leave a record, who did leave a mark, and it becomes harder and harder the further you get back through time. But of course, the people who really, for whom it is easier, are royal families and people of political significance. And this is the basis of programmes like Who Do You Think You Are, which I love watching Who Do You Think You Are. But it's not a representative way of looking at the totality of your ancestors, because you've got two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents. You keep going back like that and it doubles and doubles and it doubles. When you do Who Do You Think You Are, you do your family tree, you're picking probably one person out of 32 or 64 or 128 ancestors that you'll have at that point. So we also know that we can't keep doubling the number of ancestors that we have every generation, because if you go back 1,000 years, it means you've got 2 to the power of something like 30 ancestors, which is trillions, and that many people haven't existed. So what we now know is that family trees, they branch out from you, and then at some point they start collapsing in on each other. Mm-hmm. So there's two key ideas in genetics, in population genetics, that are relevant here. One is the MRCA, the most recent common ancestor. So the most recent common ancestor of two first cousins is your grandparents. In genetics, you want to know the most recent common ancestor of huge populations. And when the calculations were done, initially using maths and subsequently using genetics, the most recent common ancestor of Europeans occurred only 600 years ago. So what that means is that if we could draw a perfect family tree for everyone, every European, then there would be at least one branch on everyone's family tree that crossed through one individual person round about 1400 or 1500. And again, not metaphorically or not conceptually, actually. So our shared ancestry there is just so recent that I find it breathtaking. Actually shocking. That. And then the next time point of great interest is called the ISA point. And this is a bit trickier to explain because it feels really counterintuitive. But it's the point at which every branch on every living person's family tree crosses through every living person in the past, right? So all of your family tree branches out from you, and then it folds back on each other, and about five or 600 years ago, it crosses, one branch will cross through one person. But it becomes so convoluted after that that there is a point in history where everyone's family trees crosses through every single individual, right? And when those calculations were done, the answer came out at about the 10th century. So what that means is that if you were alive in the 10th century and you have descendants who are alive today, then those people were the ancestors of literally everyone alive today. Okay, so we think that about 75% of people alive in the 10th century Europe have ancestors alive today, and the other 25%, their lines died out at some point. So then you go, okay, so who do we know was alive in the 10th century? And you go, well, we know that royal families were alive then because we have family trees to prove it, written down. And you say, well, Charlemagne is the one we use. Charlemagne was alive in the 9th and 10th century. We know he has descendants alive today because you can do those family trees. And indeed, Christopher Lee, the great Dracula, Scaramanga, the Wicker Man, we know his family tree because he was descended. His mother was an Italian countess, and we know he was descended from Charlemagne. Richard Branson did his family tree and announced that too earlier this year, which is cool. Good for you, man, because it's true. But it's true for literally everyone as well. Me and you might not be able to do our family tree back to Charlemagne, but we can say with 100% certainty that it is as true for Richard Branson and Christopher Lee as it is for us. We're recording this a day after Danny Dyer was in the news, who's done Who Do You Think You Are? And it turns out that he's descended from William the Conqueror, I think it was, which is cool. 99% of British people are descended from William the Conqueror.
Well, that point, which is somewhere in, what did we say, 500, 600 years ago, when everybody in Europe is basically related, has a common ancestor, what is the point where everybody that's alive now in the world has a common ancestor?
Yeah, 3,500 years ago. And I love saying that because, again, how can that be the case? So how
am I related to, you know, some tribesperson in Polynesia or you know, an Aborigine or some guy that lives in the middle of the Amazon jungle?
Yeah, fair question. So the genetic ISA point for everyone on Earth comes out, according to the models, at about 3,500 years ago. And that's really conservative. When you loosen up the constraints, it goes to about 3,600 years. So way, way more recent than anyone ever thought. And way past those migratory patterns that we were talking about earlier, when we, you know, people out of Africa 100,000 years ago, 50,000 years to Europe, and then they spread over the world there. But it's only in history, during the time of, you know, the Egyptian Empire, or thousands of years after the Chinese had invented writing, or the time of the ancient Greeks, there is common ancestry for literally everyone. Everyone alive today is descended from everyone alive 3,500 years ago. As you say, how can that be the case for South American tribesmen? Is a good one. If it hadn't been for the conquistadors turning up in the 16th century in South America and spreading their genes in the South American continent, then your question would be correct. Then your challenge would be correct. Because they had been isolated for more than 20,000 years from the people of Beringia, so what is now the Bering Straits, who they migrated across from Asia and filled the Americas. But the fact that the conquistadors turned up and mated with the locals, it takes very few generations for bits of that DNA to filter through to literally everyone in South America. So tribespeople who've been isolated for otherwise thousands of years, it doesn't take many generational sexual encounters for that to filter through. And we now know that there are no people in South America who do not have European DNA in them. Again, I think we find it hard to think about this because we think about families in a very short time period. We think about our parents and our grandparents and our children. And beyond that, it immediately becomes murky and it branches out. But the conquistadors turned up 400 years ago. That's a lot of time for people to have sex and move around. And if there's one thing that humans are good at, it's having sex and moving around. That's two things.
I'm Alex Krotowski, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Now, we've already established that I'm from Leicester.
Yes.
Leicester, a place, incidentally, that that has a really good place in the history of genetics.
Yes.
You know, genetic fingerprinting was pioneered at Leicester University. I can remember when the first person was convicted, Colin Pitchfork, from a genetic fingerprinting.
Yeah.
But of course, being from Leicester, I obviously have to be obsessed with Richard III.
Yes, you do.
So let's talk about the identification of Richard III and how that actually happened.
Yeah. So the Ricardians are an amazing society based in Leicester, who've been running for almost 100 years now, I think, who are just interested in revisiting, possibly reassessing the historical place of Richard III in history, because mostly we think about Richard as being a dastardly villain. I think mostly we think about Shakespeare's portrayal of Richard III, which is fictional. That, according to my sources, Shakespeare was making this stuff up. So there is, I mean, it's one of the historical plays, and there's a lot of history in there. But I think it's not a non-fiction account. So reassessing Richard is an interesting thing, and he is interesting historically for a number of reasons. That he's the last Plantagenet, he's the last king of that particular, the last ruler of that dynasty, and because he's beaten by Henry Tudor, who becomes Henry VII, that is where the royal lineage that we currently have begins. So Bosworth is where it happens, and the contemporary accounts, which are quite slight, say he's killed on the battlefield, he's paraded around, stripped naked, paraded around as the vanquished leader, and buried without ceremony, without pomp, in Greyfriars, the monastery. Now, that's it, right? That's it for 500 years, more than 500 years. We don't know where that location is. There's a couple of records, so Henry Tudor, Henry VII, put a monument to him, an alabaster monument, about 10 years after his death, and we only know of that from a receipt. During the dissolution of the monasteries, Greyfriars is dissolved by Henry VIII, and the brick sold off, and then Greyfriars is gone. And you know this from being from Leicester. Greyfriars is an area of Leicester, but there's no surface remains of the monastery itself. So the Ricardians and the University of Leicester, and particularly involving geneticists now, particularly an excellent scientist called Thierry King, got together using the paper trail initially to try and identify where Richard's burial, last resting place, might be. Now, on day one of the dig, which is amazingly lucky, or possibly shows how good they were doing the paper trail, they dug in a car park, the social services car park in Greyfriars in Leicester, just outside a wall which they thought was similar in position to the wall, the external wall of the monastery. Day one, dig up, find a body. It's called Body One, and it's immediately of great interest for the following reasons. One, it's naked, so no traces of clothing, no traces of a burial shroud, no traces of a coffin. The second thing is, the grave is clearly too small for this body. The head is cocked forward at an uncomfortable angle. So this is someone who's been put in the ground in a hole that was not dug for them. Number three, it's the body's hands. It's a male. The body's hands are positioned on his right hip. Now, there's no trace of binding, but the suggestion is that this was a person whose hands were tied. The feet were missing, but we don't think that's of any historical significance. It's been in the ground for that long that might just be, through gardening or building or something like that. So immediately you're thinking, well, this is not a bad contender on day one. You get permission from the crown to exhume the body, which is what you have to do for any body, and it gets cleaned up. And the first immediate forensic pathology that is very obvious is that there is profound scoliosis in the spine. Now, scoliosis is a condition where your spine curves, normal spines curve in an S shape if you look sideways on. Scoliosis occurs in an S shape if you look forward, front ways on. And it doesn't give you a humpback, but it does mean that one shoulder might be higher than the other. Mm-hmm. And the amount of scoliosis, how it was pronounced in this body, meant that the left shoulder would have been significantly higher Now, immediately you're like, well, this is the crookback. Richard Crookback is how he was written by Francis Bacon and others. You know, the crooked usurper is how Shakespeare describes him, this villain. So you do have not a hunchback, but a guy with his shoulder significantly raised. Shakespeare has him with a withered arm. There's no evidence of this body being a withered arm. But yeah, then there's the pathology of the skull, which is a total mess. The two major head wounds. One, a slice off the back of the occipital lobe, which probably would have been immediately fatal, probably from a flat-bladed instrument weapon, something like a halberd. And then on the other side, there is a puncture also sort of underneath the occipital, which is the back bit of the head where the sort of neck joins the skull. And this is a smaller hole, but there's a scratch mark on the inside of the skull. So this is a spear, or possibly the pointy bit of a halberd, that has gone right through the skull to the extent that it's scraped through the brain and it's scraped the inside of the skull. So, you know, again, major, almost certainly lethal head wound there. And you say, well, how does that tally with the history? So, because he would have been wearing armour. If this was the king, he would have been wearing armour. Jean of Molinet, who's one of the chroniclers of the time, says that he took his hat off in order to rally troops. You say, you know, I'm the king, here I am, I'm still fighting. So, again, possibly consistent with the contemporary narrative. And so there's loads of physical evidence. The fact that he has wounds on the bones of his hip indicate that he might have been stabbed, possibly through the buttocks, and that might be that he was slung over the back of the horse having been stripped naked, because he would have been covered by armour. Anyway.
So that's all very interesting physical evidence.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't know the veracity of all of those old stories. This is pretty circumstantial.
It's so pretty good history, actually. And I think one of the reasons I love telling this story and why it's in the book is because this is really the high point of using DNA to complement traditional forms of history. So the paper trail leads them to the grave in the first place. Then there's physical using things like scanning technology to look through the ground, classic archaeology, or modern archaeology, in fact. Then there's the dig, and you get to the bones, and then you're into forensic archaeology or forensic pathology, and you're looking at the forensics and how this person would have died. So this is all older disciplines, and then the key to it is the DNA.
Yeah, so let's get on to the DNA.
Yeah.
So how does that change things?
So you get DNA out of the bones, and then there are two strands of DNA that make up a very small proportion of your total DNA, but they're very useful to genealogists because they are only inherited through the male line or the female line. So the male line is the Y chromosome, which is only passed from fathers to son. And then there's the mitochondrial genome, which is only passed from mothers to children. So you take the DNA from the bones in the car park, and then using the family tree, and because he's royal, we know the family tree well, and you try and identify living people who are descended via the maternal and the paternal line. Two groups were identified. On the male side, five living descendants who didn't want to be named, but they're named Somerset 1 to 5, were identified. And you compare the Y chromosome of them with the Y chromosome of the bones in the car park. And they were not the same. So there's a problem there. They did the mitochondrial DNA and identified two living descendants, Wendy Duldig and Michael Ibsen. And the mitochondrial DNA was identical in Michael Ibsen and differed by one letter in 37,000 in Wendy Duldig, which is unequivocal, beyond statistical noise, evidence that the bones in the car park are the same matrilineage as the two living descendants. So that basically says it's Richard. The discrepancy in the Y chromosome says something equally interesting, which is that there is, at some point above Richard in his family tree, there is a cuckolding event. So someone hasn't been honest. Someone was fathered or mothered by someone who is not recorded in the family tree. We may never know who that person is, but technically, it means that the current royal family is not biologically related to Edward III, which is hilarious. They have yet to comment. I mean, the truth is that Henry Tudor conquered in battle. That's where the claim to the throne lies. Nevertheless, it is biologically true.
We mentioned that I'm from Leicester, the home of genetic fingerprinting.
Yeah.
You're from Suffolk.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, completely coincidentally leads us on to talk about inbreeding. So,
Neil, come on.
Let's talk about I want to talk about Charles II, who was the last of the Habsburgs. Yeah. He wasn't a well fellow, was he?
No, I think this is my favourite story in the book, and I think there's enough distance between us and the end of the 17th century to be slightly wry about his awful, troubled existence. But yes, he was born profoundly disabled, physically disabled, mentally disabled. He had a suite of problems. He didn't learn to talk until very late. He didn't learn to walk until very late. His tongue was so swollen in his mouth that he couldn't retain food in it, and his speech was garbled. He died at age 38, sterile and infertile, hadn't left an heir, and he had a profoundly troubled life. His nickname was El Hechizado, so Carlos El Hechizado, which means the hexed or the bewitched. And the reason he was that bewitched and he had that hexed existence was because his family stopped outbreeding around about 150 years before he was born. So whereas you and I, including if I'm from Suffolk, thank you very much, we should have 256 people eight generations back. Charles had something like 29. Mostly, yeah, it's just awful. It's awful. It's so tragic and appalling. And they're mostly intergenerational, so uncles with nieces. And when you look at his family tree, and I show it in lectures, people gasp because it's sort of incomprehensible as a family tree because it has loops in it. And you should never have loops in the family tree. And he has dozens. So his grandmother was also his great-grandmother on one side, and then and you can say that so many times about so many people in his family tree, and it all stems from one pairing, Joanna of Castile and Philip the Handsome. And Joanna of Castile, she had a nickname as well. She was known as La Loca, which means the mad or the insane, and she had various mental health issues that we've tried to diagnose posthumously. But she occupies positions in three generations. Multiple positions in three generations. There are at least nine routes from Charles to her. And it basically means, when a couple of years ago, his inbreeding coefficient was calculated, which is basically a measure of how similar your genome is from your mother and your father, the inherit copy from each. And it came out as 0.254. Now, if a brother and a sister successfully have a child, their inbreeding coefficient comes out as 0.25. So it meant that more than a quarter of his genes were identical on both sets of chromosomes from his parents. And that is bad, bad news. It means that the chance of a recessive disease emerging are extremely high. And in fact, we can't even diagnose what was wrong with him because there are so many genes expressed that should have been suppressed. It's an interesting story. It's kind of a fun story in a dark way, but it also says something about the relationship between genetics and history, because what follows is the collapse of the Habsburg Empire and the Spanish War of Succession, where various families are around Europe are contesting the empire and the Holy Roman Empire. And it's the reason they inbred is because they wanted to hold on to power. They wanted to keep it in the family. And that is exactly the reason that they lost power forever.
So I've been talking to Adam Rutherford about his book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Stories in Our Genes, which is out now. Adam, thanks for coming in again and sharing it with us.
Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.